Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello, you lovely Wirestripped listeners, and hello, Kobe.
Hello.
It's me, Dave, and we are back for part two of our David Simon special. So if you haven't, if for some reason you clicked part two of this interview and you haven't listened to part one, what are you doing? You don't know how podcasts work. Go back to the feed.
It's not just podcasts. I don't know how pop culture works.
or numbers.
Yeah.
You clearly don't know how numbers work, and that's okay. The first one is one. It was last week, or mere minutes ago, if you're a patron. Head there. This is a long 90-minute interview we got with David Simon. And I guess, Kobe, without further ado, we will throw to us in the past talking to David, right?
Well, yeah, let's just go to David. He's the most important person here. So we have a Patreon account, guys, if you're listening, patreon.com/thewirestripped. And this is where we hold all of our exclusive interviews that don't go on the main feed. And any money is generated from the Patreon goes to the Ella Thompson Fund, which we'll talk about, like I say, later on. One of the perks the guys get is to, they get first dibs generally about asking our guests the questions. So this is Alex Watson from our patron asking, how do you feel that The Wire's influenced the TV industry and the way that the themes of the show are explored, and how and were you hoping to change the nature of the discussion of these subjects in the creative media?
I think the greatest influence in terms of craft or structure or whatever we're calling it, in terms of the making of the actual TV show, we were utterly committed to the idea of one story carrying through. So whereas I came out of, you know, I learned to write TV on Homicide, which was 22 episodes on NBC. And some of the episodes would be length. You might have a two-parter or, you know, even a three-parter once or twice, but mostly they were standalone episodes. So they were kind of like short stories. So, you know, if you were writing a show like Homicide, you were basically writing, you know, you weren't doing Ulysses, you were doing Dubliners, you know, to use a literary metaphor. And they were all linked short stories. They were of the same place, and they had some of the same characters. But it was basically a short story collection. And having written a couple of long form books that were like about a year in the life of Homicide, you know, a year in the life of this drug corner, I was really interested in the idea of what would happen if we could just make it all one story. And TV was at that moment capable of offering that. And the evidence to me was not The Sopranos, which I guess beat us out by a year, but because I didn't know what The Sopranos were doing at all. But I did see Oz. I saw Oz early on because it was by Tom Hanna, who was the showrunner who trained me on Homicide. So all of a sudden, Tom's got the ear of this cable network that doesn't have commercials, that will show the show, you know, that will deliver the episodes, you know, 4, 5, 6 times a week. So if you miss it on Sunday, you catch it on Monday or catch it on Wednesday. That's a recipe for being able to sustain something that's more akin to a novel on television. So that novelization of the of long form television became possible. And this was even before box set DVDs or streaming. I mean, it became more and more possible. You know, you missed the show all 5 times. You know, you want to see it all, you want to binge it all at once. Here's a set, a box of it, of discs. Stick them in your freaking computer. Enjoy, go, you know, just watch it when you want. that was the next revolution. And it came, followed hard on the heels of the arrival of premium cable. And then right after that, streaming, which is basically, here's the library. Here's your library card. Have fun. That makes it possible to do a very complex story, very ornately, and not worry about it. Our viewers can remember from episode 3, you know, who Omar is. It made it possible to do a very adult treatment of a narrative, very much akin to a modern multi-point of view novel. And you could see that. You could see the potential when I watched those first episodes of Oz. So it was Oz, really, and Tom that preceded The Wire and deserves credit. But we were there very early. And I thought we executed pretty well in terms of making a continuing story where people would start to believe that we could juggle all the characters and say something. And so I think that's, you know, that's what exploded after The Wire. I think we showed that you could tell a long, ornate story over multiple episodes, and people would find it, and people would be able to maintain their interest. And I think that's probably our legacy.
You actually made a nice companion piece with Oz. That's how I experienced The Wire first, on TG Cahir, yeah. Ireland's premier Gaelic language channel. Just so you know, they picked up Oz and The Wire, and they were back to back on a Thursday night.
I know, and I knew
it was nice evening.
I knew it played on the Gaelic channel. I knew that.
I'm glad to hear it. And you snuck in a James Joyce reference as well. I'm very impressed.
I confess I'm not an Anglophile. I like the country; it's fine. But I am. But you stick me in. You know, you get me off the boat in Wexford, and I immediately try to be Irish.
That's
I'm Jewish. I'm Jewish, so it's, you know, use language as a weapon and carry a grudge forever.
And, yeah, very familiar.
Very familiar. Right?
Yeah,
Delaney Whelan's got married in Ireland.
Yeah, Guggan Barra.
Yeah.
Oh, really? Well, so did Dominic West in Limerick.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. I missed that wedding.
So did I. Great trio.
My son had just been born. I'm sorry, my daughter. I'm mixing up time frames, but my daughter she was only a week old, and I could not get on the plane. It felt like total dereliction. So I didn't do that, but man, I wanted to go to that wedding.
Do you keep in touch with a lot of the old crew? Do you have a WhatsApp group?
No, you know, we see each other when we see each other. And we all talk, you know, social, you know, I mean, you can email anybody and you can text anybody. So it happens all the time. Probably a week doesn't go by where I'm not talking to two or three people. Usually about, not about work stuff, but about the world or about each other, or, you know, good news. Somebody had some good news. Somebody did, you know, complimenting somebody on something. Or to be honest, you know, sometimes the phone rings and it's tragedy. So there's a real sense of family to the show. So, yeah.
We certainly do get that sense, having spoken to a lot of the cast and crew, that there is this close-knit sort of vibe.
It was different than a TV show. I mean, it was not just a gig. It started as a gig. I mean, if you talk to a lot of them, Wendell tells a really funny story about watching the first couple episodes. We showed him to cast and crew. We were still in production. And we showed him a couple episodes, and he watched it, and he's like, call your agent, because this thing ain't going. Slow, it's ponderous. They don't know what they're doing. This thing going. You know, so I mean, like, you know, by the end, the fact that we'd all been through it and we'd actually survived and said actually what we intended to say, there's a lot of familial camaraderie. There really is.
That's lovely. Well, speaking of familial camaraderie, we have a message from our patron, from Ian Tunmore, who wanted to ask you. He says, The Wire and some of your other shows depict deep frustration that the system is failing the people. He wants to know, are you more or less frustrated now than when you were creating The Wire?
I'm more frustrated. I mean, I think it's evident that my country, and I think this probably reflects the UK at this point as well, but I'll speak specifically to my country. We have become extraordinarily good at politics. And by politics, I mean the ruthless savaging of the opposition without any regard to the ideas undertaken. Content doesn't matter. Maneuver matters. Power matters. What you actually do with that power, what you achieve with it, whether you leave your nation better or worse, is not the issue. The issue is maneuver and attack and dominate. And we're great at that now. We've got it down to a almost instantaneous news cycle of who's getting hurt, who's hurting them, how are they doing it, what can they use next. We're great at that. We've become we may be the modern synthesis of media, media dishonesty and avarice. That's our political system. We are terrible. The worst we've ever been at governing ourselves.
What do you think has enabled that in the past 20 years in particular?
Well, I think there was already a paralysis that had resulted from it. I think there's always been an intense divide in my country that dates back to the Civil War over things like race and class. It was often submerged. You weren't given the same permission to speak of it as in these last few generations, this particularly this current one. That was always there, and that could always be in American history, you know, in certainly all of our post Civil War history, but even before, that could always be excited by political rhetoric. You could go there if you wanted to. And some people wanted to, but there was some sense that it was being civilized. I mean, we had a civil rights movement in this country. The worst excesses of our racial past were being slowly addressed. But we're in a period of backlash now that's been aided by something that is profoundly different, which is the death of truth. I worked as a reporter for a news organization that would not print things that were not true if they knew them. Seems like a basic concept, but you know, I'm not saying we didn't get stuff wrong. I'm not saying we didn't overlook some of the great trends of the day. I'm not saying we were always insightful, but before you sent your story to the copy desk, you wanted to know that every fact in it was true. You had to double source shit. You had to be able to defend it to your editor. I take great pride in my history as a reporter in the times when I saw stories, sometimes my own, go to the Metro Advance basket instead of going the paper, meaning this story needs to be worked more. We're not sure it's true. We're not sure it has a lot of true facts, but we're not sure that it is saying what we should be saying about X or Y. So it's going into the kill basket for a while until somebody figures out how to make it good or more true. And those moments don't exist in our current media culture. They certainly don't exist on social media. That, you know, we all thought there were assholes who were like teaching in journalism colleges 20 years ago, 25 years ago, when the internet raised its head, who said, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. You know, we've gotten rid of the gatekeeper. Now everyone can have a say. Now everyone's opinion can be heard. It's the ultimate democratization of information. We don't need gatekeepers. Yes, we do. Yes, we do. You know, otherwise, if we don't need gatekeepers, then, you know, then external actors can send targeted social email information, you know, through various systems to particular populations, particular cohorts, and convince a significant number of voters that, you know, that Hillary Clinton is, you know, has a political career only because she's been able to get rid of 400 people who she's had killed. I mean, that one went around the world. I mean, it went around, it went through Wisconsin, it went through Pennsylvania. I mean, you know, the studies have been done. And you know, we're incredibly susceptible to horseshit now. We have given in to the idea that facts don't matter. Well, when facts don't matter, then, you know, it's a hop, skip, and a jump to the point at which, you know, Jews are drinking the blood of Christian babies, you know, baptized babies, in order to gain power and to fulfill their, you know, heinous little ceremonies and start building some concentration camps. You know, I mean, Goebbels figured this out a long time ago. The bigger the lie, the more they believe. And we've reached that point as a culture. You know, mainstream media now, in its gatekeeper role, has been rendered irrelevant. And I don't know what you do with that, because representative government requires voters to be
at informed. Least,
yeah, informed. I wasn't going to say informed is almost too big a word, but I was going to say like marginally informed, like not certainly not following absurd conspiracy notions into the horizon. And 30% of my country, 25% of my country is pretty much capable of that right now.
Do you think this is the worst case scenario of what you were trying to say in season 5 with your fake news sort of plot line?
Yeah, we were trying to say what were we attending to? What excited us? What excited us as a culture that we were attending to when we weren't attending to all the previous things that we showed you were happening in this city that were being unattended to? That was our argument in 5. Right. And what's kind of funny about that is, like, you know, at the time we were like thinking sort of celebrity news, which is still the case, you know, I mean, you know, whatever Amber Heard and Johnny Depp went through with each other seems to have, you know, more traction right now than whether women can control their own bodies in my country.
Yeah.
In the 21st century. So, you know, go figure. But so partly it was that, but partly it was like, you know, even the culture of reporting was like, you know, I can't tell you how excited, and this was true in Hollywood too, how excitable people are at the idea of a serial killer. The evil man. The singular evil soul who just wants to kill and kill and kill and kill. And usually in the most, you know, if you add some sexually perverse, you know, appetite, you know, that, oh man, you know, let's run wild. And that gets a lot of attention. But the violence in my city, for as long as I covered it, was endemic of the drug trade or the corner culture. Sometimes it was just arguments, you know. But it was basically guys with guns who, they weren't serial killers in the classic sense of they were killing out of, you know, psychosexual compulsion, you know, or they needed FBI behavioral scientists charting their psychosis. No, it was people who went down to the corner with a gun and solved every fucking argument by shooting somebody. And until the police came and got them, they would continue to shoot people. You know, and that went back to the 1980s. I mean, it was like, and it, you couldn't get anyone to attend to it. It just wasn't important enough. It wasn't in the right zip code. It wasn't exciting enough. It was, you know, I mean, I remember I was doing the book Homicide. There was a kid named Roddy Milligan, and he was like 17 years old. And he was from like the Longwood, Westwood area over in West Baltimore. And shot one guy, and they figured out really quickly who he was, and they got a warrant for him, but they never quite picked him up. He was never at his mom's house, or, you know, he was on the run. And then he shot another guy, and then finally he shot a third guy, and they still hadn't picked him up. And finally, Terry McLaurin, a very funny philosophical cop, said, you know, you shoot one guy in Baltimore, okay, it's Baltimore. You shoot two guys, you know, well, you've got sort of got our attention. You shoot three guys, maybe it's time to admit you have a problem. God. And there was something so darkly funny about, like, you know, Roddy ended up shooting four guys before they finally, you know, swooped down on the right house at 4 a.m. and got him. And this guy wasn't a master criminal. You didn't need to know. It was like, he was a 17-year-old kid with a gun. And that was the problem. And it was like, you know, this is, was he a serial killer? No, not in any classic sense, but Did he take four lives before somebody, he finally got the full attention of the city? Yeah. So, I mean, that's what we're trying to say.
This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
We've got a question from a patron guy going to talk about season four. This is Dominic Tollan from a patron. As a school teacher, season four really resonated with me, especially the aspects of political bureaucracy and the system failing the young people within. Do you see this as a continuous loop, or do you think there is a way to break this cycle?
You know, this would be a better question for Ed Burns, because I will say that was totally his experience having taught. After he had done 20 years as a detective in the Baltimore Police Department, Ed did 7 years teaching middle school he taught middle school at Hammond, and then he taught a little bit of high school at City College. And those were his experiences. And I will say he was enduring at the point at which No Child Left Behind was gearing up. And those artificial and sort of prefab notions of what progress looks like in an educational setting were problematic. Because a lot of the same things we saw in the police department were the gaming of the system. As soon as they create a stat, there's three guys in the basement trying to figure out how to game that stat and make it look like there's progress when there's no progress at all. And that was true in every agency I ever looked at. It was true in journalism too, in some basic ways. It's always a problem. So that was a particular target of those years. And I'm not sure, I can't speak to every, you know, since that was basically a legal and policy paradigm that was thrown over the top of education in America at that moment. I'm not sure if I should speak too generically about it in other places. But yeah, that it's such an to me, it's such an ineffable thing how to teach a kid to think on his own. That's the hard thing to make a kid a thinker, and to make him question the first thing that comes is put in front of him, and maybe ask a few more questions and think a little harder and trust his own judgments. That's epic. That seems to be the height of great teaching. Whether or not you can make the kid respond to test questions might not be the best metric.
At this point, David, what we tend to do with our guests is kind of move to the exclusive section for the patrons. This is to encourage people to go to join our patron account. Like I say, all the money from a patron goes to the Ella Thompson Fund. We do that, I think this is a nice kind of segue to talk about middle school, Ed Burns' experience. Can you tell us a bit about the Ella Thompson Fund from your point of view, why you guys have supported it?
Before Ed and I started writing television, our task at hand was we went to a drug corner, a drug-saturated neighborhood in West Baltimore, at random, kind of, in 1993, and we followed the people there. We wrote a book. And one of the people we followed was a woman who I weirdly had met before. Ella Thompson was a woman who, from that neighborhood, who, whose daughter, 12-year-old daughter, Andrea Perry, was raped and murdered in 1988. And I had actually been in the homicide unit to write my previous book that year. And what I didn't remember when I first met Ella was I'd come to her door with the detective, who was actually Ed Burns' partner, who caught that case, and Harry Edgerton. And Harry solved the case, solved the murder. But I remember coming to her door to notify her that her daughter's body had been found. And so like, I'd walked a little ways beside Ella in this moment of grief and then the case evolving afterwards. And then 5 years later, I found myself in her living room because she had volunteered. After that tragedy, she volunteered to open up and start to reconstitute the small rec center in that neighborhood. And typical reporter, you know, that story was 5 years old. I didn't quite remember Ella as Ella, until she started recounting what drew her to the rec center. She said, my daughter was killed. And as she started, I was like, oh my God, I've met you before. I mean, I didn't say that loud, but like later on, I conceded to her that, you know, even though it was really an astonishing moment for me that like 5 years later, in a different context, I needed a reminder. So we became friends and close with Ella because a lot of the kids who were in that neighborhood and were even on the drug corners, they were like, they're like man children. They're like, you know, they weren't like drug dealers. They're 14-year-old. So they'd go from the rec center and play to selling drugs, you know, in the late afternoon. And then they go home and have dinner. You know, it's hard to describe in a drug, you know, how much of a company town a drug saturated neighborhood is. So we became close with Ella. Long story short, as the book was coming out, or just a little after the book came out, she was sort of one of the heroes of the book for all of her work in that neighborhood. Shortly after that, she died of a brain hemorrhage, very young, probably carrying all kinds of stress. And by then she was working for the Parks and People Foundation of Baltimore, who were funding her. She was doing programming at like four rec centers. And she had asked us to do one thing, Ed and myself. She had said, look, she said, you don't pay for journalism. I get that. She understood that you can't do checkbook for journalism. She goes, but when you guys give speeches can you maybe like donate? And we said, that's a great idea. I said, whenever we speak, whenever we have any opportunity to do charity, whenever we have a speaker's fee or something for appearing on some program, we'll send that to Parks and People and you'll have an extra fund that you'll be able to use for programming for your rec centers. So we did. And at first it was, you know, who were we? We were two schmucks who wrote a book. So it wasn't a lot of money, but it was something. And then at a certain point, we were making television and we had the wherewithal of HBO, and HBO would help us run charity events and stuff. Anyway, there's now almost $2 million in that account. You know, it has a budget throws money into programming for kids every year in Baltimore and park and recs programming and, you know, job training and other things like that. So
and you featured it as an episode point in season four of Ella Thompson fundraiser that Carcatti went to.
Oh, you know, I forgot we did that. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. We were a little, yeah. And Carcatti did. I actually met Marty O'Malley at an Ella Thompson fundraiser. And I was the head beat, I offered the most money to have lunch with him. Mm. And I did. And the reason I did that was A, it was money for the charity, but B, I had to break it to him that we were going to start on a new show called The Wire. and I had to say to him, honestly, look, you know, you've had two, Baltimore's had two bites of the apple with homicide, the corner. If you want me to shoot this one somewhere else, I will. It could be any Rust Belt city. And he was like, no, it's fine. We want the film industry. We're fine. And then after seeing one season of The Wire, Marty was like, get out of town. True story. But I put Carcatti at that because Marty did graciously attend. So
how did Marty O'Malley feel about Carchetti because he was in one of the influences.
Oh, he did not
right?
like that. He did not.
Yeah.
Like that. Oh, you know what? I mean, we gave him some distance. We made Carchetti Italian American. You know, we did that on purpose. But he, yeah, there were some elements that he clearly recognized as himself. Some of the rhetoric. I mean, you couldn't. Yeah, we're writers. We use what's in front of us. You were the mayor. These are the things you did. You championed mass arrest. You championed the drug war. You know, I'm sorry, but you know, to this extent, that's my critique. You know, some of the stuff you did is going to feature. But I will tell you that I went to see the Pogues play in Washington at the 9:30 Club, and the guy I went with was Aidan Gillen, mm-hmm. another abiding Pogues fan like myself.
Yeah.
And we were standing there, and Streams of Whiskey starts playing, and I look over to see who's here at the next chair over, and damned if it isn't Marty O'Malley. I had the great joy and pleasure of introducing him to Aidan Gill. That was the coldest handshake. The coldest handshake you've ever seen.
We are running out of time, but we did have a question on Twitter from Joe Kiley, one of our contributors at Shite Guys Pod. He wanted to ask you about the Pogues musical.
Sure.
If you could give us a couple of minutes on that.
Sure. I've been working on this thing for a decade. And I think part of that is I'm working with George Balcanis and Laura Lippman. We've been contending with the play itself and where the songs fit in and what we're trying to say. We're on our about 10th or 11th rewrite. I just got another gist. I had to stop working on it because we Own the City came up, but I just got notes from Oscar Eustace at the Public Theater in New York. They're good notes. It allows for us to go in a different direction. I would say there's two problems and they both have to be solved before this thing can be properly staged. The one problem is I never wrote a musical before and neither did George or Laura. Maybe we're not really good at it. That's one problem that has to be solved. But if we solve that, we actually, the thing has enough promise that we've stayed with the public and they've been giving us notes and it's getting better. So, I mean, maybe we're going to solve that problem. The second problem is it's always a trick when you have pre-existing songs as the Pogues discography is, and you need to fit them into a story that, you know, they all weren't written for. It's not a musical where you come up with the idea and then you write the songs. It's quite the opposite. It's a jukebox musical. So there are moments that work really well, really well. And the songs are perfect. And there are others where it's kind of, you know, the lyrics are a little bit oblique and it's tricky. And so we're trying to do it so that I don't want to do it and have it not be good. You know, these guys deserve better than that. Yeah, you know, Shane McGowan's one of the great poets.
Yeah.
Our time, he really is, and they deserve it to be right. And so I've, you know, there've been times where I've had to put it down because of other projects. You know, the paying gig took precedence, but I hope to get back to it shortly, and I hope to turn in that 11th rewrite. Maybe that one will be the charm.
Well, let's talk to one of those other projects that We Own the City, bringing you back together with George Pelicanos, Ed Burns, the whole Homeblown Deadline production team. I love it when I see Nina K. Noble on there because I know what's going on.
I can't work without her.
And
I wouldn't know how to make a TV show without her.
And so Rena Rexroad on there as a producer this time. So can you tell us about We Own the City? Obviously, it's steeped in true life.
It's a natural coda to what The Wire was saying. It came upon us as a found singular piece. It's nonfiction. It's journalism. It's about a police unit that went incredibly corrupt in Baltimore.
Here we have producer Tom earning up, holding up "We Own the City" by Justin Fenton, the source material for the TV show.
I was just while we're on this subject, I just wondered, you know, you talk about a lot of your stuff is about greater truths, and we're you know, with The Wire at the end of it, we found there's a greater sort of a bigger truth to it, and I wondered if that was something that you saw in this book as well.
I just saw it as being, I'd say if The Wire's message was end the drug war, the message of these last 6 hours is end the drug war, but it's capital letters and there's a period after every word. Because where The Wire left the story was you're emphasizing the wrong things. You've lost yourself in the stats. You've lost yourself in that, which is not police work. And you're no longer attending to what might make the city better.
Mm.
We're saying that. We showed you Herc and Carver shoving money into their vests and stealing. We showed you randomized street violence by cops against people, you know, break the kid's fingers for stealing a car, you know, beat the shit out of a guy in through a car window because he irritated you with his car horn. We showed you the where it was going. But it needed one or two more generations to get to the point where an entire police unit would not only steal some of the cash from when they turned over a mattress, they would steal the drugs and then sell the drugs back on the street to other drug dealers. They would rob not just drug dealers, but civilians of their cash. You know, that's a level of cynicism and dystopia that requires, again, that leeching of integrity and leeching of purpose that the drug war gave to law enforcement, so that the guys who were doing bad things in isolative and small ways in 1980 or 1990 were now running units and were recruiting the guys who would do that shit with them. And that's where we were headed. And it basically, you know, when I saw the stories coming out, because I'm, you know, I live in Baltimore, I'm reading them contemporaneously, I called Justin Fenton, the reporter, and I said, Justin, you need to write a book. And I gave him the name and number of my book agent. And then I called my book agent and said, you know, to my agent, make this happen. This guy's sitting on an incredible story. And so that's all I thought. I was responding journalistically to somebody who had Justin's old gig on behalf of Justin. You know, that's all. I wasn't thinking of TV. Lo and behold, you know, a year later, Justin's manuscript is circling around HBO, and Carrie Antholis, one of the execs there who'd worked with us a lot, he showed it to George and said, what do you think? George came back to me and Nina and, you know, game on. But we had no intention of coming back to the Wire universe. But this thing was such a standalone coda to the argument we were trying to have. You must change this mission. You must end the drug war. That we felt we had to do it.
With the Corner, then the Wire, then We Own the City, do you feel, I don't know, do you feel there's some kind of completion now, some kind of arc there? Or
they're all separate pieces. I mean, The Corner was about the culture of addiction and really about a broken nuclear family. And it didn't have a lot of room for policy or critiquing of national priority. We put a little of it in places we could, but that left room for The Wire to be argued. We felt like we argued all with The Wire. This piece, I mean, as I said, I think I hate to be one of these assholes that leans hard on I told you so, but, you know, we told you so. We said this about the drug war, and now we're saying it again. And, you know, we're shouting, but you know, what happened in Baltimore was where this thing was gone.
I've been lucky enough to see a couple of episodes. I've read the book,
same.
And it is extraordinary. For some of the Wire fans over here who won't have seen it yet, there are some nods, there's some stylistic nods to The Wire. And I wonder whether they came reluctantly. Did you have to have your arm twisted to do that? I mean, thinking more about the time codes and the shots of the shots of the computer screens and stuff.
I mean, we break time in this. One thing I've never done before is break time. And the reason we did it was we didn't want just a narrative linear, like, oh, here are some bad cops. Here, like, watch them do bad things and then watch them get caught.
Yeah.
Then all you're thinking is, hey, they just got to get rid of the bad apples, which, no, this thing is systemic. We wanted to show you the why. Why did this happen? Why was a police unit this empowered to do this kind of stuff by people in authority? Why were they valued? Why were cops like this valued? To do that, we had to go back in time in one way and show you the world that trained them and got them to this point. But we also needed to go forward to when they're all arrested and they're in their prison jumpsuits and they're like being debriefed by FBI agents. They're basically explaining who they were, why they did what they did, and how they reflect on it now, because that's where you start to get insight. So the time is going every which way, and I'm not worried about it. I feel like it's stronger for it. But yeah, if you're a viewer that is used to The Wire going perfectly linear, you know, and you're trying to do your laundry or, you know, type your emails while you're watching the show, you might have a little bit of a problem.
That is not a good way to watch The Wire.
We probably were hard show to watch anyway. This is probably a step harder.
Yeah. What is it you say about the casual viewer?
Well, okay. You know, anyway, do you want me to stay with the Joycean metaphors?
Yeah.
If The Wire was Ulysses, then this is Finnegan's Wake, and you know how many fucking readers got lost in Finnegan's Wake. We all know how many people quit on page 80 of Finnegan's Wake.
Nicely done.
I'm not going to quit on We Under City. I'm reading the book at the moment and watching the show.
In the end, there may be moments of confusion. By the end, you'll see the power of the thing coming full circle. Written as a whole piece, and I really think it does work, but it asks something of viewers, which we're not uncomfortable doing. But it does feel like, I will say there are some buried references to The Wire. Obviously, we use some actors again, usually not in the same type of roles. You know, we tried to.
Yep, Poot. Trey Chain is a cop. Every time I see him, I'm like, I can't deal with this in my head. Yeah. Yeah. Tiny head wants to explode.
That's our way of actually saying we're breaking path with The Wire. It's basically saying like, don't. And first of all, actors get to work again. They got to eat too. so you try to use good actors again, but by making corner boys cops and you're basically saying no, don't link this to The Wire in any. But there are other moments where we basically said, here's a little something if you're a Wire fan. That moment in the first episode where John Berthold's character is walking foot, and the guy comes out of the liquor store. And he's got a bag and a bottle.
Yeah, yeah. Allusion to Bunny Colvin's.
Yeah, it's somebody who has even discarded Colvin's metrics for cohabitation and cooperation with the community. And that it happens over this perceived moment of, are you respecting me or are you not respecting me? Is there enough respect? You know, what's the look on your face? And he just gets so many, smashes the bottle. When he smashes the bottle, I thought every Wire fan would go, oh.
Yes. Oh, I did.
That's wrong. There's a little something in there.
Guys, yeah, amazing. David, Simon, I did talk about having met him in the pub when he's angry about Prison 45, and it was a pleasure to meet them, but it's a pleasure to ask him about The Wire and all the other stuff he's done in between. But there's more. Part three.
Yeah, if you are not a patron, this is where your journey ends. So you can get off the train here. If you are already one of our lovely patrons donating to the Ella Thompson Fund,
or want to be a patron,
Please head on over to patreon.com/thewirestripped, where there is an exclusive remaining third part of that interview with some, I gotta say, some really good audio questions from some other cast crew members.
You've heard a few of the cast members with questions. We've got the rest of them in this last section. Just a quick fire round of a few questions. So The Wire Strip, sorry, not thewirestrip.com, although you can go there, but it's great. Go to patreon.com/thewirestripped and join if you're not a patron. We should say we have a few different tier levels, and typically this kind of thing is reserved for the higher tiers, but what we're going to do is keep it open to everyone. So we're aware that some people are struggling as much as possible, but we do want to raise money for charity, so we'll have this episode available to any tier that you choose to participate in. And hope you enjoy it.
And again, a huge thank you to all of our patrons there and everyone who has joined in the past, and a reminder that all of the money goes to the Ella Thompson Fund.
As a special treat for fans of The Wire, David Simon will be signing he's going to do an auction, and he's going to sign some books, posters, amazing treats that we'll auction off and donate the proceeds of that to the Ella Thompson Fund. So do stay tuned to our social media at The Wire Stripped, and David Simon's Twitter. If you're not on David Simon's Twitter already, then go there, because it's a source of absolute delight every single time he posts. But that's
he loves to take down trolls. He's really good at it as well. Yeah.
it's chef's kiss every time he takes down a troll. And that's at AO Despair. Follow both those accounts, and as the auction items come live, you can go there and bid and help raise more money for the Ella Thompson Fund. So like, retweet, and donate if you can do.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.